This week on Potlatch, Rosita Worrell, formerly of the North Slope Borough, talks about subsistence hunting. Was the music of Ian and Sylvia, now Rosita Worrell.
I'm originally from Southeast Alaska. I grew up there, and I started off to school, and my work in school brought me to the North Slope, where I've been doing research for the last 2 years on the political development of the North Slope NUPAC, and I concentrated on that intensively for about a year and a half. And as part of that work, I was looking at the traditional political elites, which led me directly into the whaling complex and expanded into the subsistence question or complexes that they have on the North Slope.
How were you making a living while you were doing all this studying on the North Slope?
Well, fortunately, I had a fellowship for a while, but the other really unique part was that I was receiving support from the North Slope Borough. In exchange, of course, for some, you know, review of helping them develop or analyze some of the impact statements. They did provide me with support. They, you know, gave me an office, and it was a really unique situation where they realized the value of my work and gave me support in return.
The Tundra Times has reported that subsistence hunters in Anaktuvuk Pass were using charter airplanes to hunt sheep, and that they really did not need meat because the airplanes brought in store-bought food into Anaktuvuk Pass daily. Rosita Worrell comments on these reports.
Yes, it's true that there were a lot of planes that were flying into Anaktuvuk, and in fact that the villagers complained that those planes were filled with sport hunters who flew into the area and who began, and I'm talking about 2 years ago, who flew into the area and began hunting the caribou before the caribou had, you know, started through the pass. And, you know, one of the things that the Anaktuvuk Pass people know is that you have to let the first groups of the caribou herd go through the pass so that the rest of the herd will follow them through. Well, what happened was that the sports hunters who were stationed, you know, at the pass diverted the herd from going through. And so some say that they went along the pipeline, which was an easier access route for them. Well, I don't know what happened to them, but nevertheless, there was no very few caribou going through. It's true that the Anaktuvuk Pass people did have a certain amount of food, but I say that if it hadn't been for the sharing complexes, the trading activities that the North Slope people have developed over the years, is that we would have been faced with a very disastrous situation where you would have had a group of people who didn't have any sort of food availability at all. So what happened was that the people from the North Slope, and I know in Barrow, they started gathering food, sea mammals, and other surpluses that they might have had, and they shipped it into Anaktuvuk Pass. And I think that's how a disaster was avoided. And that's the kind of social system and the social welfare system that exists on the North Slope, whereby the people take care of themselves. And it's a social system that's working, it's viable right now, and it's not entirely dependent on the outside.
We've heard of comments that subsistence, after all, is on the way out. It's doomed. The cash economy will take over. Do you agree?
My research has, indicates, my research and my personal experience indicates that subsistence is a very viable activity, and that rural Alaskans are involved in it totally. But I want to clarify that and say that they're involved in it either as a subsistence user themselves, as a recipient of subsistence goods received through the various sharing mechanisms, or as a subsistence harvester, somebody who actively goes out to obtain the subsistence resource. He in turn distributes it to his family and his in-laws, and then there's a sharing pattern that's quite extensive. I think that we're bound by old thoughts, old scientific thoughts, and perhaps even federal policies that we're trying to advocate for a movement away from a subsistence economy to a cash economy. My work has shown is that there's a interrelationship between a subsistence economy and a cash economy. To some people, it looks like a dual economy, but in fact, in essence, it is one economy with based both in subsistence and cash. But it's definitely not on the wane. And if we do a historical analysis, we'll find that there were periods in Alaska, in Alaskan history, where Native people went through a boom-bust cycle, where there was a lot of Western economic activity, but as soon as it was withdrawn from Alaska, they went back to almost a total dependence on subsistence economies. In the North Slope, it was when the commercial whalers came up there, and they nearly depleted the bowhead whale, and after the Western world had no further need for the bowhead whale, they left, and the northern Eskimos reverted again to almost a total subsistence-based economy. And then we had the fur trapping era, and then what I call the military construction period, where they were involved in cash. But after each one of these periods, there was a return to a subsistence economy.
Rosita Worrell was asked if subsistence hunting could survive without a cash economy.
At this point, I'd have to say no, because I think that that saying that subsistence is purely an economic activity, and it's not. And from my work with subsistence, I found that subsistence is, yes, it is economic, but it's more than economic. It also has its social aspects, which I was talking about. The distribution system and how it ties the community together. And then there's also that real strong cultural attachment to subsistence. And I think those three elements are the things that work together to make subsistence very viable. And then, of course, the other aspect is that there is no way, you know, in under present conditions, that a cash economy, first of all, it's not present in rural Alaska to any degree. In one community I found, you know, where less than 10% of the people were employed at all in any, you know, in any capacities. One, you know, I counted even people who had an hour or two jobs a week. So it's just not feasible because the cash economy is not present in rural Alaska. And even where it is available in a limited degree, the cost of living is so high, it's extremely high in rural Alaska, that one could, even if one were making $30,000 in Alaska, he's still having difficulties. But then, and that brings in the other aspect, is when we in the Western world are talking about a cash economy, we're usually measuring economy or cash on an individual basis. You make money and you spend your money. In rural Alaska, a man who makes $20,000 has to support not only himself, his family, but his in-laws and other people as well.
Listen to the pouring rain, listen to it pour. And with every drop of rain, you know I love you more. Let it rain all night long. Let my love for you grow strong. As long as we're together, who cares about the weather? Listen to the falling rain, listen to it fall. And with every drop of rain, I can hear you call. Call my name right out loud. I can hear above the clouds and down here among the puddles. You and I together huddle. Listen to the falling rain, listen to the rain. It's raining, it's pouring. The old man is snoring. Went to bed and he bumped his head. Couldn't get up in the morning. Listen to the falling rain, listen to it fall. With every drop of rain, I can hear you call. Call my name right out loud. I can hear above the clouds and down here among the puddles. You and I together huddle. Listen to the falling rain, listen to the rain. Listen to the falling rain, listen to the rain. Listen to the falling rain, listen to the rain.
The music of Jose Feliciano. During hearings in Fairbanks on subsistence hunting, several witnesses charged that giving native subsistence hunters priorities amounted to discrimination against non-natives and non-subsistence hunters. Rosita Worrell responded to that charge by commenting that she noticed that
a lot of people who were not familiar with the legal history of their own country and their own country's special legal relationship to Native Americans, that was really evident to me. But if they were familiar with their legal history, they would know that the United States has a very special relationship, a legal trust relationship with the Native Americans, that goes beyond, you know, just being an Alaskan. And so the conflict, you know, comes in understanding that. And so I have to go back to say that there is this legal relationship between Native Americans and the government. And then secondly, when I look at, you know, some of the activities of our government, I think they were very wise in developing this National Environmental Policy Act of 1971. and whereby they recognize that economic activities, you know, occurs within a cultural and a social context. But more than that for Alaskans is that they recognize that we do have a cultural heritage which we should be protecting. And I think for Alaskans that I know and very close with is that they're very anxious to protect this cultural resource, and that cultural resource happens to be a different way of life for some people. I was in D.C. For the hearing on bowhead whales, and one of the things that was most evident to me was, yes, that the conservationists are concerned about Japanese and Russian whale hunting, and in that regard, they're willing to trade off Eskimo hunting. And I think that it's a political issue, and I think that the positions that they have taken about the bowhead whale is based on inaccurate and not documented work. And they've ignored their own reports by, or our reports by, our National Marine Fisheries, which states first that the bowhead whale population is rising. If you read the reports put out by the National Marine Fisheries, they acknowledge that the bowhead whale population is rising. My own work and interviews with whaling captains in the North Slope confirms this same finding. The second misunderstanding comes from the misreporting by the National Marine Fisheries. And this is a really, really very difficult thing to understand now, or maybe to explain. But the National Marine Fisheries counts strikes and losses. And I think this is what everybody was up in arm about in D.C. But what happens is that you have a National Marine Fisheries person out on the ice, and he counts a whale that goes by, and it is struck, and then it's lost. And then the same whale goes to goes on down the lead, that's the open water, and it is struck again. And that second strike is counted as a separate, another strike and loss. It might happen that that same whale will go further down the lead and will be struck and taken. And so you have National Marine Fisheries reporting two losses, two strikes and two losses, but in actuality, it might have been taken by the third party, third whaling crew. I have heard that there's been up to 7 bombs found in the same whale, and from my understanding of the National Marine Fisheries reporting system, that might be counted as 6 strikes and 6 losses. So I think that figure is really inflated. And then I wanted to say also that there are mechanisms to find out who owned that first whale. I mean, I know that this happens because last year there were 2 separate incidents where whaling captains had struck a whale and they were pulling it up and they were ready to cut it up and then distribute it according to the sharing patterns that they have. And they found the second captain's bomb in the whale, and they had to return the whale to the first captain. And I know that they were counted in, you know, the strikes and losses. Then the other aspect of whaling, and let me tell you, there's no conflict between conservationists wanting to maintain the animals, any kind of animals. Native people feel the same way, because the occupation of rural Alaska is based on the availability, the continuing supply of the products or the resources. So there's no conflict there. And I think some people, you know, are under the impression that Native people are just out, you know, to kill the game and don't care about the numbers at all. They're keenly aware that their success, their livelihood, depends on the continuing availability of that. So I think the whaling issue is much more complex and then we know about. And certainly we haven't, or the people from rural Alaska haven't had the opportunity to go out publicly and say, you know, hey, I think there's something wrong with the reporting system, the kind of outmoded weaponry that they're forced to use, or at least they're under the impression that they can't modernize their weaponry.
What are the physical reasons why someone kills a whale but is not able to recover that whale?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to tell you that a whale measures from 30 feet to 60 feet. It weighs a half a ton per foot for a small whale, and maybe a ton a foot for the larger whales. That whale is pursued in a small skin boat by people using what I call outmoded weaponry. And whales have always been lost. And my feeling, you know, my analysis of whaling techniques shows that whaling is much more effective today than it ever was in the Aboriginal period. But it is, you know, it is a large animal. It's a very difficult animal to get and hold. So it's not like running out and shooting a buffalo.
What are the weapons that are outmoded?
Well, I can't go into a whole lot of detail about the equipment itself, but I do know that they use bombs, and the bombs are more or less handmade. And according to information I have, is that there are people, commercial people, who say that it's Neanderthalic, you know, the kind of weapons that they're using, and that there are, you know, different types of weaponry that could be more effective.
Would you go into some of those political reasons again, why the United States apparently will not back the Eskimo whale hunters?
Well, back in D.C., that reason became very evident, and that was that we know that the United States has taken the leading effort in the whale struggles, or protecting the whales. And from what I heard and understood back in D.C., they were saying that, you know, we're asking all of these other nations to give, and to show our good faith, we're going to have to give something in return.
The United States then would feel that if they were to back Eskimo hunters, they would be perceived as hypocrites?
Yes, I think so. The other interesting thing to me about that whole the process of that was that there were no Eskimo people, there were no people present when those kind of decisions were made. And in fact, you know, it just happened at the last minute when the North Slope and people found out about it. And they filled the newspapers, you know, with a lot of kind of publicity that I think that supported their position.
Well, what would happen if the ban were to go through? Would Eskimos respect that ban, or would they ignore it?
I can tell you that Eskimo whaling is going to continue. It's their life. There's just a strong attachment that's developed over 4,000 years. What happened when Christians were told that they could no longer worship their God? I'm not saying that it's a religious sentiment, but it is as strong a tie.
Do you think that it's possible the Eskimos will run out of whales if they continue hunting?
No, I don't think so. I mean, like I said, the bowhead whale population is increasing. Your own National Marine Fisheries reports say that. They are reviewing their own activities now. They set up their own whaling commission to advocate for more research. It's really surprising to me that in spite of all of the OCS activities, that very little attention has been given to the bowhead whale population. And I mean, then all of a sudden we hear about Eskimo whale hunting. And I think it's kind of a camouflage for the other kind of activities that are going to be going on up there. No, I think the Eskimo people are being used, and I think that they're concerned They have been the ones who have been writing and saying, hey, we need to have more work to find out about the ecological system of the bowhead whale. It's the Eskimo people themselves who set up their commission to monitor their own activities, to look for modernized weaponry, to, look at ways of cutting down on the loss.
Of John Gary. And this is Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening.
Potlatch came to you from KUAC in Fairbanks. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting gave some of the money to produce this program.